Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Bullitt Foundation, the Furthermore Division of the Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the Collector Car Hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, a landslide kills four in Oregon and state logging laws are called into question. A scientist crawls through the brush in Africa to follow baboons. Invasive species cause billions of dollars in damage and hurt the environment. In the East, hemlock trees may become a thing of the past. And the Earth plows through a sea of debris and spectacular meteors fall. These stories and more coming up on this week's Environment Show. Just over a week ago, after a period of extremely heavy rain, a mudslide came crashing down a vertical slope in Umpqua, Oregon. It enveloped a house in the valley below, and all four occupants were killed. Francis Etherington, from the Umpqua Watershed, Inc., a local environmental group, describes the history of the home and the land above it.
In 1973, these people homesteaded this area, built their houses, and on Hubbard Creek, and on a little side creek called Rock Creek. 13 years later, in 1986, the industry-owned land above them was proposed to be clear-cut by Champion. And so they submitted the proper papers with the Oregon Department of Forestry, were required to follow the Oregon Forest Practices Act, and commenced logging in 1987 and 88. And they did a clear-cut of 168 acres. They left, as was not required by law, to leave any riparian buffers on the headwaters up there of Rock Creek. It was very, very steep land. It was so steep the tree cutters had to rappel into the area to cut the trees down. It was classified as a high-risk area for mass soil movement.
Champion International, which owned the land and did the logging, filed papers with the Oregon Department of Forestry, who sent a forester to inspect the site before they started cutting. Francis Etherington was able to obtain from the department the notes the forester filed.
These notes document that one of the residents that was killed, it's written in these notes that the foresters visited him on October 29th, 1986, and I will quote from the notes. "We let him know what we were doing there and what was proposed for the area. He does not oppose the logging, but is concerned about any slide that may block the creek and flood at a later date."
Under the Oregon Forest Practices Act, the state forester could have required Champion to file a written plan, but the notes indicated that a written plan was not thought to be necessary. Even if a plan had been requested, it does not appear that the department had the authority to stop the cutting, since it was occurring on private land. A spokesman for the Oregon Department of Forestry says they are now doing a study, which will be finished in a year, to see if there is a correlation between clear-cutting and landslides. Andy Stahl, who is executive director of a group called Forest Service Employees for Environmental Ethics, which is based in Eugene, Oregon, says the correlation is perfectly obvious.
Since the mid-1970s, we and other scientists have known that clear-cutting accelerates landsliding dramatically. This February of this year, after a big storm, I went out in an airplane and surveyed from the air landsliding on one Forest Service Ranger District near the Pacific Ocean. And in that survey, we found 114 landslides that were in clear-cuts. We found 68 landslides that were right next to and caused by logging roads. And we did find three natural landslides, acts of nature. All of the others were created and accelerated by the forest practices.
As nobody to date has claimed the Champion Company violated the Oregon Forest Practices Act when it performed the clear cut on a vertical slope, the question is whether the Oregon law affecting logging on private lands and similar laws in adjoining states are adequate. Stahl thinks the law needs to be changed.
The first thing I would do is recognize that there are some hillsides so steep that we shouldn't be permitted to clear-cut log on them at all. We have similar restrictions when it comes to siting buildings, or building in floodplains, doing anything that imposes an unwarranted risk.
As you look at the state laws in the Northwest, are any of them adequate from your perspective? And I'm referring now particularly to laws that affect logging on private lands.
None of the state legislatures in the West has sought to regulate logging to protect public safety or protect natural resources sufficiently. They don't even come close. All of our state forest practice acts in the West were written by timber industry lobbyists and passed by very sympathetic legislatures.
The deaths in Roseburg, Oregon, raise questions not only about the adequacy of the state laws to protect resources, but their purpose as well. Lou Torres, public affairs specialist with the Oregon Department of Forests in Salem, Oregon, makes it clear that protecting people is not what the forest practice law or his department is intended to do.
First of all, the Oregon Forest Practices Act really isn't there to protect people. We're not a public safety agency like a sheriff's department or fire department or whatever. Our Forest Practices Act, we administrate it basically to allow for forest operations while at the same time protecting soil, water, air, and fish and wildlife. So really, those are our clear objectives of the Forest Practices Act. A homeowner who lives or chooses to live on forest land near where there is commercial forest land or commercial operations that are taking place, really that homeowner or whoever lives there really is taking a sort of a risk in a sense, because anytime you live in around forest, you may have a forest fire, you can have some slides, you can have a lot of other even, you know, natural disasters that can affect you. So really, the Forest Practices Act is doing what it's designed to do, but one thing it doesn't do is really it doesn't protect a homeowner from you know, some kind of a natural disaster like what happened down near Roseburg.
The fact is that in Oregon and elsewhere, more and more people are living in the woods or close to them. And many, like the folks killed at Roseburg, built their houses before the clear-cutting began. One such person is Karen Henderson, who lives a mile up the road from where the Umpqua slide occurred. The property above her home is owned by a timber company. And last summer, the logging roads on it were improved and trees were marked, right up to Mrs. Henderson's line.
I truly feel that our lives are in great danger if that logging were to occur. I don't understand how they could do any logging at all and not affect the watershed and be able to say, no, we won't have slides. Roseburg Forest Products in the early 80s did logging a little bit farther down the road on the same unit, and that in turn, there was a slide following that destroyed a home.
As pressure mounts to limit future clear-cutting on private lands in the Northwest, it seems nothing is being done to assess or stop the danger caused by the logging done 1, 2, and 3 decades ago that contributed to the most recent slides. I'm Peter Burley. The Environment Show is going interactive in a new segment called Talking Green. We want to hear from you about environmental issues. Call us or email us, and we might ask you to join us on the air. Our email address is envshow@aol.com. That's envshow@aol.com. Or call us at 1-800-323-9262 and go to extension 600. That's 1-800-323-9262, extension 600. You won't get on the air right away, but you'll be able to leave a message, and one of our producers will get back to you. Or you can go to our webpage, where you can see our topic of the week. We're at www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. Africa is a land of contrast. In some areas, poverty and warfare are constant blights. But Africa also contains pristine wilderness and sweeping beauty. Scientists have been drawn there by wildlife which live close to their natural conditions. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally recently spoke with Craig Packer, author of the book Into Africa. Packer is a researcher who has worked in Africa for over 20 years. He calls Africa a world where individual existence is all but lost in the vast rhythms of life.
East Africa has got to be one of the most beautiful parts of the world. You have this great geological formation, the Gregory Rift. Africa is splitting up. It's actually breaking up at the seams. One of those seams runs down through Tanzania and Kenya. And on either side of it, you have these great volcanoes which are spouting out. Some of them are still active. Not far from our house in Serengeti is a still active volcano that's due to go off any minute now. So you get a sense of a landscape that's new and fresh, and it's a very vivid way to live. But on the other hand, there are these undercurrents. It is a dangerous place, and if one is attracted to the glamour and attracted to the beauty, one also has to be prepared to cope with the downside of it, with the risks. And they're not hypothetical. They're not bedtime stories to keep kids, you know, honest. They're very real and they're very threatening.
And I guess in many ways they mirror the animal life there.
They absolutely mirror the animal life. If you were a baboon, if you were a chimp, you would live much of your life in stark terror of your own kind. If you're a male baboon who's trying to move from one troop to another, there are any number of bigger, older males who would like to kill you. If you're a male chimpanzee and you happen to be out on the edge of your own range and you get caught by a neighboring group, they'll kill you. If you're a female chimp and you've got your baby too close to strangers, they might kill your baby. If you're a lion, it is almost certain that you are going to die because you're killed by the lions. It's one of the great myths about animals that they, unlike us, are very kind-hearted and look after each other. That's a very strange attitude. It really is, I don't know where it comes from. I think it's a fantasy. The fact is that animals are brutal and that they lead very harsh, dangerous lives, and they live in constant fear of each other. And it's certainly more extreme in some species than others. And the species that I study over there, these baboons, the chimps, and the lions, all share in common with our own species this tendency towards organized battle against each other, group against group, gang against gang. And the kinds of things that are threatening to us are very, very familiar, would be familiar and recognized by any lion, chimp, or baboon.
You mentioned this one baboon, I think his name was Samson, and you talked about how he was in some ways like you in this one point. Did you find yourself gaining kinship with creatures like Samson?
Oh, absolutely, yes. He was a baboon who was the equivalent of an almost college graduate baboon. Young male, just reaching maturity, and he'd been nurtured within his family setting, within his troop, all of his life. And he, like every other male baboon in Africa, just about, then has to go through this great adventure of leaving home for the first time, leaving his family, and then going off and starting his own life, his own independent existence. And this absolutely resonated with me because I was over there just graduating from college, wondering what I was going to be doing with the rest of my life. And it was striking to me that this particular animal was leaving this warm safety of his family, going off, and at every turn he was meeting other males who would dearly love to have grabbed him and just killed him. I mean, he was in this life-threatening situation constantly, and yet he wouldn't stop. He kept having to go through that trial by fire, that initiation into his new life. And it was his persistence, I guess. It was his tenacity that really struck me.
Craig Packer is a professor at the University of Minnesota and author of the new book, Into Africa, published by University of Chicago Press.
Invasive plants and animals, like kudzu, zebra mussels, and purple loosestrife, have cost the economy billions of dollars and hurt the environment. These organisms outcompete native flora and fauna, contributing to the decline of 42% of U.S. threatened and endangered species. One such invader is the hemlock woody adelgid. It threatens to wipe out most of the hemlocks in the eastern U.S. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally looks at what the effect will be.
In the south, kudzu covers whole stands of trees. In the Great Lakes, zebra mussels clog intake pipes. And in 49 states, purple loosestrife crowds out native plants. The costs from invasive species like these total more than $1 billion each year. The hardest hit industries are agriculture, fishing, electric utilities, and tourism. The problem is so bad that some native species have been nearly wiped out. One species headed towards near total elimination in the wild is the hemlock.
This entire landscape is going to change dramatically sometime probably in the next 5 to 10 years when the hemlock woolly adelgid reaches this part of New England, infests these forests, and kills all of the trees around us.
David Foster is the director of the Harvard Forest, a research facility in central Massachusetts. All around us are hemlocks doomed to meet their fate in just a few short years. The hemlock woolly adelgid is an aphid-like creature that attaches to hemlock needles and sucks the life out of the trees. It arrived in Richmond, Virginia sometime in the 1950s. Scientists believe it was brought in from Asia on an imported ornamental tree. Since then, the adelgid has wiped out whole forests of hemlocks. David Orwig is a researcher at the Harvard Forest. He says in Asia, the adelgid has predators, but none exist in this country.
There's been no evidence to suggest that anything inhibits its spread. Now, it has been in Pennsylvania in the easternmost portion as early as the 1960s. It hasn't spread too far west yet, but it's, you know, along the Delaware River water gap area. And in areas that become infested, that have looked very much like this, I've seen where all the trees have died. So I'd say the chances are pretty good that unless, you know, biological controls are found to inhibit it, odds are pretty good that forests like this will be changed dramatically.
For instance, today in Connecticut, you can see acres and acres of dead trees, all the result of the hemlock woolly adelgid. Invasive species are nothing new, but as humans have moved around more, invasive species have hitched rides. Zebra mussels came in ballast water from Europe, and the brown tree snake, which is causing all kinds of problems in Hawaii, is thought to have arrived via airplane tire wells from Guam. How besieged ecosystems will deal with this is uncertain, but David Foster says hemlocks have seen these sort of troubles before.
About 5,000 years ago, there's a very well-documented decline in hemlock as a tree species across its entire range. And that's been interpreted by many people as being the consequence of some type of a pathogen which arrived to a pre-European landscape and naturally decimated hemlock across its range. Hemlock evidently was able to develop, through natural selection, a resistance to this pathogen and to recover to the abundance that we have today. So the good news is that this kind of process has already been experienced by these forests and that hemlock has once before been able to evolve a resistance. The bad news is that that process took about 1,000 years.
When the hemlocks reappear, it will be in a vastly different forest from today's. Dr. Bruce Stein is with the Nature Conservancy, which has done a major study of invasive species nationwide. Stein says the best way to approach invasives is to prevent them from getting here in the first place. Once they're established, they're nearly impossible to get rid of. So scientists are concentrating on keeping invasives from spreading, rather than trying to wipe them out. Stein says it's only recently been acknowledged as a national threat.
When you look broadly across the country, there's really a tremendous number of plants and animals that have come into the United States from other parts of the world. In fact, it looks, our best estimate is that there's about 4,000 or so non-native plants that have come into the U.S. and about 2,300 non-native animals. Now, not all of those are harmful. In fact, there's many of them that are that we depend on for a lot of things, but the Office of Technology Assessment had looked into this in some detail and found that about 15% of those really do cause harm to either the environment or the economy or both.
Stein says everyone must take responsibility for invasive species. Many plant nurseries still sell invasives, so he encourages people to plant native species. Also, invasives can hitch rides on people, baggage, and boats when they move between countries and states. By the turn of the century, most wild hemlocks in the East will be dead. Other trees will take their place, but their loss is yet another human footprint on the land. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. Normally, we discuss some natural event that's happening on the planet as we broadcast. This fosters understanding and speculation about those rhythms of nature that make our planet such a special place. This week, the event occurs in space. It's the Geminids meteor shower, visible by the naked eye over the entire night sky on December 13 and 14. Meteors of various colors will flash across the heavens, and some will explode. Bob Berman, astronomer and author of Secrets of the Night Sky, teaches that at this time of year, the Earth plows through a sea of meteorites and space debris, and what we see are shooting stars.
It looks like the best meteor shower of the year will be the Geminids, and that's on December 13th. Most people haven't heard of the Geminids because, well, who's brave enough or foolish enough to stand out in a December night, very different from an August night. So it has.
And what time of day for those?
Well, that's the nice thing. The Geminids are better before midnight. The Perseids are better after midnight. So the nice thing is that you don't have to wait till after midnight. At least starts just at nightfall, or at least when the moon sets, which is going to be around 8:30 on December 13th and 14th. You even get two shots at it. So if it's cloudy one night, you get a second chance, and romantics, people in love, can wish upon a shooting star. That's a traditional thing, and scientific types can maybe keep numbers. We expect to count up to 60 meteors an hour, and unlike the summer meteors, these actually look like falling stars. The summer Perseids look like streaks because they're so fast. They come in at about 36 miles a second. These come in at half that speed, and that's slow enough so that they don't quite burn up as fully. Also, they're made up of hardier material than the summer meteors. So put it together, and you get a very different kind of meteor shower.
Bob Berman is an astronomer and author of Secrets of the Night Sky. Unlike astronomer Berman, I'm not going to be counting the number of meteorites visible per hour. I'll do that when an imitation of the shower is available for projection on my living room ceiling via CD-ROM. In the meantime, before light pollution and smog is so bad that the night sky is no longer visible, I'm going to enjoy a natural event that is almost as grand as the stuff Disney and Time Warner and the multimedia entertainment gurus cook up in Hollywood. Besides, to create the Geminid special effects, you have to throw a ball 7,927 miles in diameter with a mass of 6.6 sextillion tons through a bunch of rocks suspended in a gravity-free void. Not even Steven Spielberg has figured out how to do that. Thanks for being with us on The Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-323-9262 and ask for program number 362. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its contents. Dr. Alan Chartok is the executive producer. Thomas Lally is producer, and Stephanie Goichman is the associate producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Bullitt Foundation, the Furthermore Division of the Kaplan Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-CARHERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.